listening to مركز الصحابة, the voice of أهل السنة والجماعة.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome back to Technology Watch. Today we're going to talk about something very, very interesting, and that is, what are the five technologies that are going to radically change our world in the next 5 years? Now, we know technology is moving at an incredible rate, and we know it's changing things all around us. But what are the five top things? And this is according to IBM's researchers. So these are not just small fry people. These are some of the top researchers in the world that are working at IBM's research facilities around the world. And they are personally involved in various technologies that are going to change the world. And this is their prediction. Now, they made these predictions at IBM's Think conference that they held last month in San Francisco. And some of these are truly, truly remarkable. Now, according to IBM Senior Vice President for Cloud and Cognitive Software, his name is Arvind Krishna. So this guy says that to meet the demands of the crowded future, and he's talking about a future where human beings are going to clock the 8 billion mark in terms of global population in the next 5 years. So to prepare for, to meet the demands of this crowded future, IBM researchers are exploring new technologies and devices, scientific breakthroughs, and entirely new ways of thinking about food safety and security. So this is what Arvind, IBM's Senior Vice President, has to say. That when we talk about these technologies, now, these are very unusual technologies in a sense that they have very little to do with actual computers and smartphones and more to do with other things in life. You know, one of the characteristics of the fourth industrial revolution, we always hear this term, but what does it actually mean? The fourth industrial revolution is actually a phenomenon where computers are no longer just stuck to our desktops or doing amazing things on the screen. They've now made their foray into the real world. Take self-driving cars, for example. In the past, you know, other than in science fiction, we could have never imagined that cars will drive by themselves, that computers will actually drive cars. So in the past, computers did things like crunching numbers, did calculations, we did our web surfing, we did our graphic design, we did our work. But now the computers have jumped out of the desktops, they've jumped out of the monitors, and they are starting to drive cars. They're starting to pilot airplanes. They're starting to drive drones. So there's a lot that computers are doing now that they've never done before. So this is what defines the fourth industrial revolution. And there's two technologies that actually combine, well, three technologies. One is a plain old computing technology that we're all familiar with. And then there's the Internet of Things. And then there's artificial intelligence. So all of these three things are working together to drive this fourth industrial revolution. So IBM's five predictions over the next 5 years have to do with artificial intelligence and Internet of Things working together with extremely powerful computers to literally radically change life and business. So what technologies are these exactly? Now, these technologies will go from seeds in the farms to harvest to shelf to table to recycling. So we get it. What's this all about? It's mostly about food production. Now, technology, we know for some time, has been moving into all fields, but now it's moving into agriculture, and in a massive way. Technology is taking over the agricultural world. And the first example is of a farm in Kenya, I believe it is, Masila.
So one problem that farmers face is that it's difficult to get it's difficult to get information about their farm to help them make decisions about where and when to plant things. Now, a small startup company called Hello Tractor believes that they have the solution to this problem. Now, what they've created is a small device with sensors on it that are placed around the farm. And these sensors monitor the farm itself. They gather information like weather patterns, dimensions, elevations, and it uploads all of this information to a blockchain. Now, farmers can use this information to determine what's the best place to plant, which parts of the farm, for example, are getting the most sunlight or water or things like that. Then, on a separate device, a separate device will actually monitor the soil itself. So, what you do is the farmer will place a small piece of soil on this device, and it will tell him about the minerals in the soil. It will tell him about the water, and again, all of this information will be uploaded to a blockchain.
So the combination of this data from the tractors and the soil samples, right, that's going to go towards what they call a digital twin of the farm. So basically, there'll be a reconstruction of that farm on a supercomputer, and farmers will be able to look at that model of their farms, and that model will use artificial intelligence to tell the farmers exactly what is going on in their farms and when is the best time to plant, what's the best pattern. I mean, these are things that most people don't even know about that are necessary on farms. Now, in doing all of this, what exactly is going to happen is that, or what is already happening, is that this technology is optimizing land usage. And by optimizing land usage, it's increasing food production quite a bit. So there's a lot of production happening, additional production happening, and these farmers are seeing better yields because now they're making informed decisions thanks to this technology. Now, it's just a matter of time before this, rather, it's kind of experimental right now, but it'll be quite some time or a short time before it becomes global. And what we're going to have is a representation of the world's farms, exactly where they are in terms of their productivity, their capability. What does the water table look like under the farm? What's the nutrient content of the soil? What is the water content of the soil itself? What's the climate like? What's the humidity level? Then we're going to have small scientists who are now given the ability of giant farms to make scientific decisions about their farms. And this is going to be phenomenal because just as we thought, you know, we've reached the pinnacle of agriculture, we're now going to go even beyond and we're going to boost production even more. And this is really amazing because all through the past century, people were concerned about food production. You know, when the world's population was sitting at 1 billion and then 2 billion, people were wondering what's going to happen to the world's population. How are people going to actually survive? How is the world going to produce enough food for so many people? And yet, the population grew multifold. It grew to 4 and 5, and now it's coming to 8 billion, and people are still wondering. But we're seeing that with the scientific progress, the productivity is increasing. But then, you know, there's another problem. As productivity increases, we're facing another problem, which is a huge problem, and that is a large portion of the food that we produce goes to waste. And that is the real disaster. According to IBM's researchers, almost half of all the food produced in the world by the world's farms actually goes to waste. Tell us about that, Masila.
The reason that this food goes to waste is that we don't have a proper supply chain. So he describes it as chaotic, that food just leaves the farm and it gets to areas, and if it doesn't get sold, it just goes bad. It's basically too much food that's being delivered to some areas, while other areas that need it are not getting food, and this also costs millions of dollars. So what they predict or what they want to do is have Internet of Things devices that will track movements of food along the entire supply chain. And this device will gather information like the temperature, how ripe the fruits are, and how close they are to spoiling. Again, this data will all be uploaded to a database or a blockchain. And using this data, we will be able to make very accurate decisions on where and when to deliver food.
So what's happening basically is that, if I understand this right, it's that this system over the next 5 years will map exactly where food is being delivered. And because there are sensors on the fruit, on the fresh produce boxes, so it will tell us where the food is actually being purchased and consumed and where it's being wasted. I mean, we see that all the time. You go to one supermarket and you see there's a pile of fruits and veggies and there's no one buying it. And then you go to another place and you find that there's a shortage. Now, this is happening even surprisingly in the most advanced countries. I mean, if you look at the food wastage in the United States, it's quite high. Now, these systems are especially designed to monitor and track this food. So over time, what the scientists will be able to do is that they will be able to exactly say where food is being wasted, where too much of food is being sent, and we'll be able to do this with a high degree of accuracy. So farmers will know that certain supermarkets, for example, in Pietermaritzburg, are in need of this fresh produce, and too much is being channeled to, say, Port Shepstone. So what they're going to do is they're going to reduce the shipments to Port Shepstone and forward it to Pietermaritzburg. And in this way, food will be distributed more accurately to places that it's needed the most, and then wastage will be brought to a minimum. Now, this is amazing technology. It actually uses a combination of Internet of Things and artificial intelligence, and one more technology, which is the blockchain. Now, what's going to happen is, from the moment the plants are cultivated, they're going to go into these little, the packaging that we normally see fruits and veggies in, and each of those boxes is going to have a sensor, and these sensors are ultra sensitive and super advanced, and they're going to be able to sense the temperature, the status of the fruits, what state, as Masila explained, what state it is in terms of ripeness or going beyond ripe and about to spoil. And this sensor will continuously monitor this, and it will communicate to a supercomputer. So all of these sensors on all of these boxes will communicate to a single supercomputer that uses artificial intelligence to understand the movement of this fresh produce through the supply chain. So from farm to warehouse to trucks to on the road to supermarkets and wholesale, every single step of the way is going to be monitored, and all of this information will be fed back and stored in a massive database, which is a blockchain database, and that information is going to be monitored. So the first couple of years, they're just going to monitor. They're not going to make any radical changes. They're just going to monitor the movement of food, and they're going to identify where exactly the wastage is taking place. And from there, they're going to, once they've established patterns, they're going to make new predictions now about where the food should actually be distributed. This is phenomenal technology. This is amazing technology. I mean, if you think about what the researchers at IBM are saying, almost half the food goes to waste. Now, imagine how this is going to impact the global economies, how it's going to impact world hunger, for example. On one hand, we got the Hello Tractor technology, which is boosting productivity on smaller farms. That means small farms are now going to be working together as if they are giant farms. And this is something definitely needed in countries like South Africa, where we've got lots and lots of small farmers. They'll be working together. They'll be able to make scientific decisions about their farms and grow much more food than they ever did before. So we're going to have highly optimized agricultural production. And now from there, we're going to totally avoid food wastage, because from the farm to the table, we have to make sure that none of this food is wasted, or very little of this food is wasted. And that's where Internet of Things and artificial intelligence technology is going to come in once again, and it's going to monitor this food and make sure there's no wastage. Now, between the extra productivity and the absolute minimal waste, we're going to have a lot more food available, which hopefully, inshallah, we'll be able to channel to those places, those countries that actually need it the most, and offer it there, you know, as relief, or offer it as, you know, at a very low price, and, you know, possibly solve world hunger in that way. This is one place, you know, where technology is doing some amazing thing. It's mind-boggling to see technology playing an active role in food production. Now, what does this mean for farmers in the future? And more importantly, what does it mean for us as consumers, and also us as professionals? How will this impact us? Now, as far as the farmers go, obviously higher yields, higher productivity, better logistics and supply chain management. What does this mean? It'll obviously mean better, higher revenues for them, because they're doing higher productivity and less of their food is being delivered to, of their produce is being delivered to places that don't need it. They are distributing to places that need it the most. So they will obviously see higher revenues. On the other hand, all through the supply chain, there's going to be people needed to monitor these, to ensure that these systems are working efficiently, that they're working properly, there's no faults along the way. Then behind the scenes, in the server rooms, wherever they're going to be based, we're going to need people that are programming these artificial intelligence systems, and people that are monitoring these systems to see that the food is being delivered properly, the food is optimal. Then there's people that are going to be assisting with making predictions about where the food should be distributed. And for us as consumers, hopefully, all of this will filter down to us, and it will benefit us in a sense that food will become even cheaper. I know food prices are going up just like with everything else, but how awesome will it be if with all of these technologies, food prices can go lower, that it becomes affordable for even the poor. So this will be quite amazing. Now, we often, you know, worry about technology and how it's progressing. And when we talk about technology, we always think in terms of cell phones and tablet PCs and computers. But here right in front of us is technology that is going to be released within the next 5 years that is playing such a key role in the food that we eat. I mean, imagine walking into a supermarket, and before you can even pick up a fruit, that little sensor is already telling you this fruit is about to spoil, don't buy it. Or this vegetable has passed its sell-by date. You shouldn't buy this. It's not fit for human consumption. Now, exactly how will these sensors actually know these things? How will these sensors be able to tell us that this fruit is ripe, or this fruit has passed its sell-by date, that it's about to spoil? Now, that is another amazing technology that we're going to discuss in next week's program. There we're going to talk about the next two of the five predictions. Today we just spoke about the first two. In next week we're going to talk about the next two, which will tell us exactly how these little sensors will operate and tell us about the food that we're buying in supermarkets. But not only that, it'll also tell us about the food that we have at home. Perhaps you bought something some time back, and now you take it out of your fridge, and you're thinking to yourself, should I eat this or not? Is this fit for consumption or not? I don't want to eat this and then, you know, have a running stomach, have tummy aches, etc. So these sensors are going to be in our homes as well, and they're going to tell us whether the food in our fridge or the food in our kitchen shelves are fit for consumption. That's all time we have for today's episode, and unfortunately we have to wrap it up. I hope you, our listeners, enjoyed and were entertained and educated by this episode as much as we were in doing the research. This is Technology Watch. I'm Bilal Katrada.
And I'm Masihullah Katrada.
And we'll catch you next time.
You are listening to Markaz al-Sahaba, the voice of Ahl al-Sunnah wal-Jama'ah.
This is The Amazing Beauty of Creation. I'm Bilal Katrada.
And I'm Talha Katrada.
And this is the show that brings you up close with the universe around you.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome back to The Amazing Beauty of Creation. I'm your host Bilal Katrada.
And I'm your co-host Talha Katrada.
And today we're going to do something a little different. Normally we talk about specific creatures and specific things that Allah Ta'ala created. But today we're going to look at not just one object or one creature. We're going to look at a system that He created, an amazing system. You know, the one thing really mind-boggling about Allah Ta'ala's creation is not just that He created individual creatures, but that He created a multitude of creatures and He put them into different systems. And those systems are so well-tuned, so well-greased, they just operate on their own. And the more we learn about these systems, the more amazed we become at just how beautiful so many different moving parts work together. I'm talking about things like different creatures and plants and weather systems and currents and tides and chemical systems, all things working together to make an ecosystem, for example, operate for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And by us as human beings making one small, tiny little change to a system, it sets off a domino effect. It triggers an effect that causes a lot more damage down the line. It's like, for example, a person has a cell phone, all right, and you simply change one setting inside that cell phone, just one little setting, and suddenly the cell phone goes bonkers and everything goes crazy. But if you didn't interfere with that setting, that cell phone would operate beautifully. Now, in the world, all over the world, not in just one or two places, in fact, all over the universe, Allah Ta'ala has made this system of things that are working together so beautifully. And one such system, one such amazing system, is the amazing, amazing Amazon jungle. Now, what's truly remarkable about the Amazon jungle, one of the most remarkable things, is that they say if the earth were a creature, then that creature's lungs would be the Amazon jungle. The Amazon jungle is benefiting us sitting here in our own countries, here in South Africa or Europe or United States or wherever we may be. The Amazon jungle is benefiting us indirectly by producing oxygen that's distributed across the globe. But there's so much more about the Amazon jungle that we ourselves didn't know about. But in doing research for this episode, we realized. And now we have a further and a much more greater appreciation about the amazing beauty of Allah's creation. So tell us something about the Amazon jungle. I know it's huge, right? How big is it really?
The Amazon jungle is the largest tropical rainforest in the world. It occupies an area of about 5.5 million square kilometers.
That is huge. Give us context. How big is 5.5 million kilometers?
So 5.5 million kilometers is roughly about 4.5 times the size of South Africa.
Wow. So that's one single jungle, almost 5 times the size of our entire country. Wow. I mean, just thinking of a jungle the size of Durban or Johannesburg, that's huge. But 5 times the size of South Africa. Wow, that's huge.
And because it's so big, the Amazon jungle spreads across a very large area, and it actually occupies areas in 9 different countries.
Okay.
And so naturally the Amazon jungle is very famous for its size and of course of its biodiversity or the amount of different creatures, animal and plant species you get there.
Okay, before we go there, where exactly is the Amazon jungle and what are those 9 countries that it occupies?
Okay, the Amazon jungle is located in South America. It occupies most of the area in northern South America. And it occupies, majority of the Amazon rainforest is in the country of Brazil. But it stretches out and it occupies areas in Colombia, Peru, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Ghana, and French Guiana. And also a bit of it is in the country of Suriname.
Okay, that's a lot of countries for a single jungle to be spread across. But I mean, the Amazon is huge, 5 times the size of South Africa. All right. In terms of the biodiversity, the plants, the trees, what can you tell us?
Okay, now naturally a forest will have trees. If you think of a forest, a jungle, 4.5 times the size of South Africa, it's going to have a lot of trees. And it's estimated that the Amazon jungle has about 390 billion trees.
Wow, that's a lot of trees there.
Now, to put that into context, if you were to take the trees in the Amazon and distribute it equally to every living person, each person will receive 50 trees.
Okay, 50 trees per person, except that, you know, I don't want 50 trees because I don't have place to keep 50 trees.
Now, naturally, those plants create oxygen, and as you said, the Amazon would be the lungs of the earth. And it's estimated that the Amazon jungle produces 20% of the oxygen in Earth's atmosphere.
So what that essentially means, right? So if the Amazon is producing all of this oxygen and the air currents are distributing this oxygen around the world, right? Am I correct in saying that? So if it's 20%, that means for every 5 breaths that you breathe in, 1 is coming from the Amazon. Can we say that on average?
Yeah, it's
amazing. Now, tell us about the plants, more about the plants, the other plants in the Amazon.
Yeah, so that, as we mentioned before, the Amazon jungle is known to be one of the most biodiverse places on Earth. In fact, they say 1 in every 10 species on Earth lives in the Amazon jungle. So if let's just say if there was only 100 creatures on Earth, 10 of those creatures would live in the Amazon alone, and the rest of the world will only have 90.
I mean, that's remarkable, but somehow not surprising. I mean, you've got a forest, a jungle the size of, well, 5 times the size of South Africa. One would expect that there'd be that many creatures in there.
Now, when you look at tree species alone, it is estimated that there are over 16,000 species of trees that grow in the Amazon jungle. So that is pretty much a quarter of all known tree species on Earth that grow exclusively in the, or grow, can be found in the Amazon rainforest. And to just to show the intensity of the biodiversity in the Amazon jungle, a study conducted in 2001 revealed that an area of Amazon rainforest roughly the size of 32 football fields could support more than 1,100 tree species. So just a small area like that, and there could be 1,100 different tree species
so
growing in it.
We're not talking about 1,100 different trees. We're talking about 1,100 different species of trees. I mean, you know, it's hard for us to imagine such a dense biodiversity, especially here in South Africa, because we've got mostly open savannas, and you could walk for kilometers and just see grass, and maybe you might see 40 or 50 different species of plants. But here you're saying 1,100 species in the size of 32 football fields. That alone shows how biodiverse the Amazon is. It's really mind-boggling.
But that's just the trees. Now, if you talk about other plants like shrubs and mosses, there could be as many as 80,000 plant species in the Amazon. Now, of course, the Amazon being so big and so dense, it's really hard for scientists to actually go and start counting how many. So what they do is they find the plant species that they know and then see how many more new ones are being discovered every year. And then through some calculations, they can somewhat get an estimate of how many species there could be in the Amazon.
I guess they're doing their best guesstimates, because from what I've read, every day there's new species being discovered in the Amazon by scientists. It's really, really amazing. You know, but the question is, you know, there's this. And what's really mind-boggling is what I alluded to at the beginning, that Allah Ta'ala made this planet, and on the planet He's got different types of terrain. So on one hand you've got the dry, arid deserts like the Sahara, and then you've got the Amazon jungle, absolutely dense forest, so dense, I mean, it must be difficult walking in there also. And then you've got your icy poles, and then you've got your grasslands. It's so amazing that Allah Ta'ala has created all this, you know, this almost this patchwork of different types of terrain, of different types of plants. But what we don't realize is that whereas something like the Sahara might seem to us as just a wasteland, a desert wasteland, but even it serves its purpose. Just like we discussed, you know, about the oceans, that the oceans in their size and their depth, they serve a purpose to regulate the Earth's temperature. The Sahara also has its own purpose. It has its function. It's not useless as far as why it's there. Allah Ta'ala has put it there for a reason. Now tell us about that. I'm really keen on knowing how, you know, what role the Sahara surprisingly plays in the Amazon. I mean, these two are tens of thousands of kilometers apart.
Okay, so plants need a nutrient called phosphorus to grow and stay healthy. And the Amazon jungle, although it has some of its own phosphorus, but due to flooding and rains and things, a lot of that phosphorus gets washed out of the soil and is lost. But somehow, the Amazon has this constant supply of phosphorus, always new phosphorus coming in. Where does all of this phosphorus or all this nutrients come from? The answer is in the Sahara Desert in northern Africa, more than 4,500 kilometers away.
That is amazing.
Now, it's very confusing to think about, but it's estimated that 182 million tons of phosphorus-rich dust blows out of the Sahara Desert every year and flies towards, carried by the wind over the Atlantic Ocean and lands in the Amazon jungle.
That is, you know, this is what really amazes me. 182 million tons every year being deposited from Sahara into the Amazon. You know, this, do you sense that none of this is happening by chance? This is a system that Allah Ta'ala has made. It's so mind-boggling. Here, there's the forest, one of the richest, most diverse jungles in the world, and it's being nourished by one of the most lifeless places in the world. It's such a beautiful balance that Allah Ta'ala has created. Now tell us, how does this phosphorus actually blow across? And how did we discover this?
Now, this was discovered by NASA. They launched a satellite called Calypso to study dust particles and cloud patterns in the sky. And they see these huge plumes of dust flying from North Africa to South America. Now, those dust grains that blow across, they're extremely tiny, must be about, the tenth of the width of a human hair. But hundreds and millions of them fly across every year. And that's, from space, you can actually see these huge plumes of dust, almost looks like clouds flying across.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And then we often think of Sahara as a wasteland, but now we see it has its own a function. Beautiful, beautiful system created by Allah Ta'ala. Now, you know, there's been talk recently of terraforming the Sahara Desert, meaning, you know, to, for lack of a better word, greenifying the desert, planting stuff into the desert and making it no longer a desert. And that, again, as much as it seems like it's a good idea and there's good intentions behind it, because obviously a green Sahara Desert will be much better for the economies of the countries in the Sahara, but we didn't realize that if we did that, how it might just affect the Amazon jungle. So that might just cause some kind of domino effect that causes damage to the Sahara Desert. It's unbelievable. Okay, so we spoke about the plants in the Sahara. Now, I know some of the weirdest creatures in the world live in the Amazon. That's one reason that if I ever go to the Amazon, I want a knight's armor or an Iron Man suit, because I am terrified of some of the creatures that are in there. Tell us something about the creatures in the Amazon.
Okay, so just like how the plants are so diverse and so many different species of plants in the Amazon, the same is true for animals. And there's estimated to be 2.5 million species of insects that are found in the Amazon forest. In fact, a single tree in the Amazon jungle was found to have 46 different ant species on it. Now, to put that into context, that's around the same amount of species of ants found in the UK, in all of the British Isles.
Amazing. So, one tree.
One single tree.
One tree has more species of ants than the whole of the United Kingdom. And that is mind-boggling.
Now, the Amazon jungle's water systems and surrounding rivers are home to around 5,600 species of fish. And approximately 50 new species are discovered every year. Now, this is not species of insects or species of animals. It's specifically fish species in the Amazon. Mm. 50 new species are discovered every single year.
And that's what I say. I mean, almost on a daily basis, people are discovering new species, plants, animals, bugs, fish. Amazing. And some of those, I'm guessing, are not found anywhere else in the world, right?
Exactly. Precisely. Now, it is still estimated that a single lake in the Amazon forest or somewhere within the vicinity of the Amazon's rivers can have more species of fish in it than all of Europe's rivers combined.
Mm, that is truly remarkable. It's either that, you know, Europe is not particularly rich in fish species, or the Amazon is just crazy rich in species. Could be both.
Now, the Amazon is also home to a lot of bird species. In fact, 1,400 bird species are found, or at least 1,400 bird species are found in the Amazon.
Probably the 1,400 we do know about.
And once again, there's new species being discovered every year. And that number, 1,400 birds species, that's a fifth of all birds that we know. So one in every five bird species that we know of lives in the Amazon.
In the Amazon. That's so amazing. I'm sure that, you know, all these birds and animals and bugs that are out there, I've come across some really scary ones. You know, there's some deadly creatures there that terrify us. Tell us about some of those.
I don't think it'll do justice for us in this episode to go through those. I think those creatures deserve their own episodes. Maybe the next episode we'll go into some of the creatures of the Amazon.
Deadly creatures of the Amazon. Like, for example, just give us a list.
Okay, so you got the green anaconda, which is probably one of the longest snakes on earth. You got piranhas in the rivers. You got poison dart frogs that can kill you just by touching them. And whoa, those are just a few.
Touch me not, little frogs. I can't wait for the next episode.
Now, in the meantime, let's discuss a serious threat that the Amazon jungle is facing.
Yeah, let's do that. I was actually going to ask you about that. Okay. We know that the Amazon is under constant threat, and we heard about deforestation of the Amazon. We heard that species are going extinct in the Amazon, especially those that have no other home anywhere in the world. Tell us about that. How bad is the problem? Is it as bad as they make it out to be?
It's pretty bad. Every year, large tracts of land are cleared out of the Amazon. It's estimated that every 2 seconds, an area the size of a football field is cleared out of the Amazon.
That is huge. Every?
Every 2 seconds.
Every 2 seconds, a football field size is cleared. That's a frantic pace. Will there be anything left after even a couple of years?
It's estimated that at this rate, within 50 years, the Amazon forests, not just the Amazon, but the tropical rainforests across the world can be completely wiped out.
But that's 20% of our oxygen right there, and so many different creatures. Now, this is a very tricky situation. On one hand, we have people that need this land for agriculture, for manufacturing, for homes. And on the other hand, we have these biodiverse forests that play a part in a vital role in the functioning of the whole planet. You know, it's from an Islamic perspective, it's really such a tricky situation. I think that when you look at Rasulullah ﷺ's emphasis on conservation, you know, on caring for the environment, on caring for creatures, I think we need to draw up a balance somewhere there. We need to put into place measures to avoid these forests from becoming completely destroyed, but at the same time, to make sure that people are not suffering as a result, because obviously people are the highest priority. If there are people suffering and, you know, that land is absolutely necessary, then obviously there is a concession. But if it's just for greed, I mean, and that's what drives almost everything, right, today. Everything is about greed, 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 more and more and more. It's like what we spoke about, the whales, right? People almost brought them to extinction, not out of necessity, but out of greed. And, you know, the funny thing about classical human greed is that it's so bad, it'll consume even the person. The greedy person will get consumed by his own greed. I mean, think about the whales, for example. If the whalers, out of their greed, wiped the whales out of the planet, wiped them to extinction, what would have happened to them? They themselves would have gone out of a job. They would have deprived themselves of an income. Now, in the same way, when we're looking at these countries, these South American countries, now a lot of these are poor countries. These are not by any, you know, middle to poor countries, and none of them are wealthy countries. I think the wealthiest would be Brazil. Now, obviously, there's a need to build the economies, but there's also a need to preserve these forests. And I think if we really put our minds to it, and if we really put our heads to it, we can come up with a solution. Otherwise, we're going to lose this biodiversity. And as much as we are having problems now with global warming, ocean currents, ocean levels rising, and erratic weather patterns, things are just going to get worse and worse and worse if we keep interfering with this system that Allah Ta'ala made. I mean, these systems work like a clock. You know, if you open the back of one of these old clocks, these mechanical clocks, and you see all of these little parts turning together, tick tock, tick tock. You just remove one tiny part, and that entire clock just stops. Now, Allah Ta'ala's systems on this planet operate in that way. So I think we really, as a human race, we can solve this problem. But we need to be a bit creative about it. I think, Talal, we don't have any more time for today. We're out of time. It's a wrap for today. I hope our listeners enjoyed and were entertained by this episode as much as we were. And we hope to catch them the next time. This is The Amazing Beauty of Creation. I'm Bilal Katrada.
And I'm Talha Katrada.
Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and on Twitter. @ABofCreation to give us feedback on our podcast and let us know if there's anything specific you'd like us to discuss in a future episode.